deluxe edition of the Story Fusion podcast. We are
Philipp
and Doro, and today we are going to talk about Frida. Frida Kahlo, the artist, painter, fashion icon, feminist icon,
queer icon. Yes. And we are going to talk about also about the difficulties of making a biopic out of an artist's life.
Or any life.
Or any life at all. Yeah, it's not an easy task to do, but we are going to talk about, we'll take the movie as a point to start off. Doro has read a lot of stuff about Kahlo, Frida Kahlo. So she's the expert here, and I'm just the one who's trying to, tag along.
So just in case you're one of the few people on this planet who has no clue who Frida Kahlo is and why you should know her, Frida Kahlo was born in 1907 in Mexico City, where she lived and died in 1954. She became one of the most famous artists, female artists, or artists. Artists of the 20th century. And thanks to several people collecting her, imitating her, whatever, she became also an icon, meaning her face, her style, her eyebrows became famous itself, more or less. And
of course, her life was turned into a movie, because if you're famous, right, Hollywood is going to make a movie out of your life. It's just...
Yeah, and it's not going to make any kind of movie. It's going to do a Hollywood version of a movie.
Yeah.
And what that means, maybe you can talk a bit about what the movie is about, and then I'm going to talk a bit about how different that might have been.
Yes, the movie is from 2002, so it's already 16 years old. And it was, the director was Julie Taymor, who is, well, perhaps best known as a Broadway director. She has made several movies, but I think Frida was her highest profile one. It starred Salma Hayek in the role of Frida. She was also executive producer on the movie, and the movie somehow got back into the limelight in a negative way because it was also produced by Harvey Weinstein, and Salma Hayek has later on chronicled her the treatment of Harvey Weinstein, what she had to endure during the creation of the movie. But we'll talk about that later. So the movie in itself begins with a bed being carried out of a house in Mexico. And as we find out, on that bed is Frida Kahlo, who is being transported to an exhibition. And this is basically the narrative frame for the entire movie. Then we'll switch, get a flashback. We will see Frida Kahlo in college, I think, art school,
yep.
Where she is...
Oh, it's not art school.
It's not art school.
No, she's going to college, and her plan is to study medicine. She wants to become a doctor.
Oh, right. Okay. And there she sees the famous, already famous mural painter Diego Rivera at work, who was at the time already a very well-known Mexican painter and worldwide celebrity and
famous communist and also 20 years older than her, so like 40-ish.
Yeah, and she already sees him having sex with a good-looking woman there, and she is not all that much interested. She is kind of a fan at the moment, as she's seen, but before she has another boyfriend, so she's not that interested. Unfortunately, she gets into, when she's around with her boyfriend, they get into a bus basically, and the bus has an accident, and Frida is injured very badly. Her spine is broken, if I'm understood that correctly.
She gets stabbed by a...
Yeah, something pierces her spine. Yeah. It's,
and goes out through her vagina, which becomes important for her whole life later.
Yes, that's true. But most importantly, she's confined to her bed for a long time. And during that time, she uses the opportunity to start to paint. And when she is, well, back on her feet, mostly at least, she will never fully recover. That's important for her entire life. When she's back on her feet, she takes some of these paintings to Diego Rivera to know his opinion about her work.
That's 1926, just to give you a timeline.
Yeah, and she Diego Rivera is pretty excited about, but she's even more excited by this young woman showing interest in him. And, well, the movie progresses pretty quickly. They basically, in one scene, they say, oh, let's never sleep with each other. In the next scene, they are sleeping with each other. And
becomes like a pattern in the movie, right?
Yes,
like most
absolutely.
Of the times it happens like something happens and in the next it's you get the solution of it.
So, well, she, Frida, quickly becomes part of the Mexican art scene where Diego Rivera is, of course, the big star. And he was, and they marry slightly, you know, the parents of Frida are not so excited about her choice of husband, especially because he has already been divorced twice, if I'm understood
the mother,
this correctly.
Seems to be very Catholic.
Yes, and the but Frida is always been very unconventional, so she doesn't really care all that much, and she even establishes a friendship with one of his ex-wives, and stuff like that. And but she becomes basically a part of the Mexican art scene through him to a certain degree, at least that's what the movie implies, and. The problem is that, of course, Diego is not very faithful. He is extreme. He's not the most attractive man, but he is, well, he is, she always calls him a fatty because, well, he's played by Alfred Molina, for those who know the actor. So, you know, he's a little bit, well.
He's a big guy.
He's a big guy. Yeah. And Diego Rivera definitely was
even bigger, I think. And.
Yeah, it's of course typically Hollywood that the actors who play the people are actually more attractive even than the persons. Well, the
I
point
think Frida
is
more attractive, but let's
not
go into that now.
later on. So the movie then goes on to basically, you know, cross off a list of all the stuff that happens in Frida's life to a certain degree. She is gets an exhibition in Paris. She is in Paris for a short time. You have to interrupt me if I'm missing something.
We missed one very important thing, which I think is also typical for the movie, which is basically, especially the first part, is more like Diego's life.
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
She's like the wife that follows. So yes. He becomes the opportunity to paint a mural in the Rockefeller.
Isn't that after Paris?
No,
it's
that's before.
Okay.
Yeah, that's in 1931, 1932. They go to Detroit together because he has the opportunity to paint a big mural in the Rockefeller Center in Detroit, which he does, but the painting gets destroyed because he refuses to leave out a portrait of Lenin.
Yeah.
So this is like the art side, but the other very important fact for Frida in this time is that she becomes pregnant by him again. That's the second time. The first time in 1930, she...
was a miscarriage?
No, she stops the...
Abortion?
She has an abortion because the doctors think she cannot handle it. And this time the doctors say to her, no, keep it. She tries to abort again, but the doctors then say...
Encourage her.
Yes, encourage her. And she loses it.
Anyway,
so she has a miscarriage, and that's like a very traumatic thing, which comes out as a very famous painting by her.
Yes,
Henry Ford Clinic. Yeah. So
and
sorry.
After this, basically this American misadventure to a certain degree, they return to Mexico because there was at least they were talking about, you know, staying in the United States, but well, Diego Rivera being an outspoken communist and Frida being a communist too, they were not very popular over there, as I have to realize. So they return to Mexico, and there she gets to know André Breton, a French writer, famous French writer, who invites her to come to Paris and do an exhibition there, and is her the first big exhibition in her life. She hasn't had one before.
She has an exhibition in New York, and then she goes to Paris. So, but that's really close to... sorry.
No, it's okay. You see, you're much better expert than I am, so it's perfectly all right. I just saw the movies. So they go to Paris. In Paris, she has an affair with Josephine Baker, because, you know, you have to cram her in that movie somehow.
Yeah, and you have to have some kind of lesbian scene in there.
Yeah, we'll get to that later on. And we and unfortunately, the Paris doesn't treat her very well. So she returns to Mexico, and she also misses Diego. She returns to Mexico. There we get, you know, things with Diego are not very well.
They get divorced.
But then basically, life throws them a curveball, as you would say, because Leo Trotsky, the famous communist from, the Soviet Union, comes to Mexico. He has to go to exile because he was an enemy of Stalin, and Stalin has taken power in the Soviet Union. So Trotsky had to emigrate to Mexico, and Diego basically has the idea to house Trotsky in the house of Frida's parents, who are have a big house. So that's
the Blue House. The famous blue
house. No. The famous blue house is the one where they later on live
that's,
together.
That's the place where she's born and where she died. So that's the place of her parents, and she paints it blue.
Okay.
And they have that's the house in Coyoacán, which is still there, the museum, and they build a house in San Angel or something in Mexico. And there, the blue part of the house, it's two houses with a bridge connected. The blue part is hers, and the red one is his, and that's a different blue house. So that blue house is and we get mixed up a bit with the timeline. So Trotsky was already in Mexico before she went to Paris, but you know what, it's not so important.
The point is, I think you are correct, but the movie explains it that way.
Oh really? Yes. That's interesting.
The movie, I mean, this is the typical Hollywood style. I mean, because they are
super
definitely
interesting. Yeah,
because in the movie it's definitely said that Trotsky is coming to Mexico right now when she is back from Paris.
Okay, yeah, that's a mess, because he came in 1937 or something like that, and she got to Paris in 1939.
But that's Hollywood. Hollywood doesn't care about facts. Another thing that we are going to talk about.
We come back
later
to that because
we'll come back to that. And The thing is, Frida gets to know Leo Trotsky, and both of them have an affair. And
says
the movie, and it's likely, I think. I read in on her Wikipedia says that it was actually likely that she had an affair. It's not actually known if she had an affair.
Yes.
But it's probable. So the movie says they had an affair. Trotsky's wife finds out that they had an affair. They are breaking up again. Trotsky moves out of the house, and Trotsky gets murdered. Basically, that's
basically because he had to move out because he had that affair with Frida. So Frida is guilty.
Yes, Frida is guilty, and she reconciles with Diego Rivera over the death of Trotsky, and then they have.
Then they get divorced.
Again?
No. They get divorced then because that's one of the reasons they maybe got divorced in real life, is that he wants to protect her because he flees the country because he's a suspect in the murder. And she also gets interviewed for 2 days. She gets held in the police station, which they also show in the movie.
Okay. They later remarry.
Yes, they do. Actually, 1 year after they got divorced. So it's like...
Yeah. Things are still the same between the two of them.
It's like a movie.
Yes, because he can't stay faithful, and she is, getting she is, well, her health is deteriorating. She is, things are getting worse for her because she has to wear a corset. She has a leg of her is getting amputated because it's getting gangrenous. And actually not much happens anymore. She dies, basically. She has her last big exhibition.
Yeah.
Her first big exhibition in Mexico, which is happened in 52 or 53, I think, and she died in 54, and that's the end of the movie. So you said when we talked about this for the first time that you would like to rename the movie.
Yeah, I mean, just by trying to retell all the things that happened, the most important things that happened in her life, you totally would suspect it to become a movie because so much happened. It's it's incredible, and so much drama happened in one life. And nevertheless, she came out with so many paintings out of it. Like, you know, so what I really didn't like about the movie was I think you should rename it Frida and Diego. Because there's basically, I can't remember one scene, and I know in the meantime that there is one, but rewatching it, I couldn't find one scene where it's not about him. So all she's doing is centering around him. And as if she were no person, no artist, no communist, no Mexican of her own.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I really, really hated that about the movie.
Yeah. And you also mentioned, and I have to agree with that, that it, the movie fails the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Very, very hard. So for those who are not familiar with the Bechdel test, it was developed by a cartoonist who based it on an idea of a friend of theirs, I think Kirsten Wallace, something Wallace, that a movie has to have two women in it, that the women have to talk to each other, and that they have to talk about something else than a man. And this is, the movie fails that extremely hard because they, of course, there are very several women in them, but all these women are talking about basically is Diego Rivera.
Yeah.
Yes, even a movie scene in the movie where she is where Frida Kahlo is seducing another woman. And what are they talking about? Diego Rivera. Because even though in that scene, Frida basically says, oh, I'm a much better lover than Diego. But it's still, you know, it's still Diego they are talking about. So that is amazing for a movie about this about this woman, about this specific woman, that it can't,
And it's amazing because the whole team consists of women.
Yeah.
So you have a female director, you have a female executive producer who plays the lead role, who, if we have to be honest, the movie wouldn't have been done without her because it was really a passion, a project of passion for her, Salma Hayek. And a female screenwriter, and it's based on a book by a woman. And there, I think we come to the core of the problem, more or less.
Yeah, and the core of the problem, or at least one of the big, big shadows, dark shadows, which is looming over the entire movie, is Harvey Weinstein, who was at the time, he was basically the, well, the king of independent cinema of in Hollywood. His company back at the time was Miramax, who had produced previously had produced stuff like Shakespeare in Love and Brokeback Mountain. I think I don't know if it's already had already made Brokeback Mountain, but that was definitely in there, and he made Pulp Fiction, for example, and lots of other movies which were tremendously successful. Salma Hayek went to Weinstein basically to get everything together to try to get this movie off the ground. And unfortunately, Harvey Weinstein abused her, as she wrote in an essay which was published in November, I think, of last year, when she talked about when the Me Too movement got off the ground. And she basically was one of the women who, he had the most damning recollection of events concerning Harvey Weinstein, because Harvey Weinstein threatened her. He basically insisted that she had to have sex with him if she wanted to make this movie, and she said no. And Howie Weinstein doesn't want to be told no. And so he made her, well, her miserable for the entire production of the movie. She forced her to have this sex scene with another woman in the movie, which is, well, if you have seen the movie, rather pointless in itself. It's just in there, you know, for, well, to put it derogatively, tits and ass, to show tits and ass. It doesn't really serve much of a purpose besides that. And still, and you can feel that. You can feel this kind of dark shadow over this movie, because it, even though it is about somebody who was a feminist before feminism was actually a thing, who had an extremely independent life, you still notice that it's just always being told from the perspective of, is this woman somehow relevant for the man who's around her? And if that's okay, that's working. So she had an affair with Leo Trotsky, brilliant, famous man we can, you know, thrust into that story. And Diego Rivera, fantastic. He's always, I mean, it would have been honest, I think, if it was just been called Frida and Diego. I mean, I think it's fine. As a concept, that would have been perfectly fine. Yeah, because, you know, two great artists in love with each other and fantastic. But, well, that's not what this movie was supposed to be. And, of course, it's a question how much of an influence Harvey Weinstein had on the screenplay. But it's certain that he did have some kind of influence on the screenplay.
Well, but I think even without Harvey Weinstein, the book it's based upon, this biography by Hayden Herrera, she's an art historian, an American art historian who wrote or published the big Frida biography in 1983. Mm-hmm. And the book, the movie used that as a source, or it's based upon the books. So she even got a credit.
Movie,
a writing credit in the movie. And basically, I think that we learn more, not more about Frida's life, or no. We learn a lot about what this woman thinks about the role a woman has in society, more about her interpretation of things than actually of how Frida really might have thought of things. Mm. So, and I think here we have also the topic we're coming back to later, how a life story is told and how you can you always have to choose, I think, which story of a which story you turn a life into. And I think that happened here too with the movie, is that they decided that Frida's life is so much more interesting when you focus it, or it's much more it will be much more popular as a movie if you have this big love romance being in the center of everything.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting to see how later generations are taking a life of a famous person and reinterpret it in a way which suits their own time. Because I think if somebody, you know, if somebody from the entourage of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo would have written a biography of Frida Kahlo, it would have turned out entirely different. But because Hayden Herrera was a US-based writer and he lived in the, well, he worked in the 1980s, you have basically this kind of American perspective of somebody of living in the in Mexico in the 1940s and 1930s and 1940s, right? It's also some kind of Western perspective on a country which is was perceived at the time of the 1980s as, well, something of a backwater country, instead of being the kind of, well, center, in a certain way, center of of international interest back in the time. Because it wasn't a coincidence that Trotsky went to Mexico at the time, because Mexico in the 1930s was considered to be a very progressive and internationally reputable country, and not some kind of a, you know, the backyard of the United States, which in itself is very interesting to consider. But you talked about one of the reasons why we are having this podcast today or recording it today was because Dore had a talk about Frida Kahlo, because she's, well, I think it's fair to say that you're a big fan, right?
Yes, I am. So I went to the Dead Ladies Show, which is a show invented by Katie Derbyshire and Florian Dosens, two translators.
And they have a podcast too.
Yes.
Check out their podcast. It's really a great podcast too. So yeah.
You find it on deadladiesshow.com.
Exactly.
So check it out.
Really great, great format, biographies of lots of interesting persons, women mostly. Well,
only.
women only, yeah. Really, so check that out. But I have interrupted you.
Yeah, I did a talk there about Frida and why I find her so fascinating. And I basically stumbled upon this biography of Hayden Herrera, who was the basis of the movie too, and discovered that it's called A Passionate Life. Frida Kahlo, A Passionate Life. And I really, very soon you learn that Hayden Herrera is a very gifted storyteller who read a lot, I'm sure. So it's really, it's her thing that Frida Kahlo popped up again in art historian circles. So that's really like, she did that. So that's her merit. But what she also did is really form that whole narrative of the artist is her work. So life work thing, which is kind of problematic if that's the only narrative. And also she has a very male gaze and male interpretation of this life and of her work, which leads to three big narratives. That is, and the most important in her view is Frida as wife of Diego Rivera. And her interpretation of that is that that was her favorite role, which you can read into some of the letters, but you can also, she wouldn't have married him if she didn't love him, right? So
probably.
And she loved him until the end of her life. We know that if we read her letters, but that's not the only side of the whole thing. So Frida as wife, Frida as shaped by pain and her sickness, which led to her being an artist. That's the one-to-one interpretation of Herrera. And the third is...
Which is also a very common, I would say, trope
about
artists' lives, that they have to have suffered in a certain way in order to create great art, which is bullshit to a certain degree.
Yeah, and it's also, I think it's also 20th century trope, leading back to the whole, the genius.
19th century genius cult.
The genius artist who's always close to being mad. And that's also something I think we see also in the movie, that her, she's kind of, well, for her, it's addiction then, but she gets enraged by that. And she,
frantic.
Her temperament, she's very emotional. And her sickness also gets questioned by Herrera as maybe she was a hypochondriac. So it's not...
Hypochondriac,
So she had to have all these surgeries, and it gets... in the way of female sickness, like Freud, you know, it's not really...
Yeah, it's not real, it's just not feelings.
It's not real, and that's a total male view on women.
Yeah.
So that's also part of this biography, and also part of this narrative of pain being the motivator of her artistic side. And the third, and that's like the most easy to work with, let's call it that, is Frida as seductress. So the woman as seductress. And I think that goes back to her meeting André Breton, the French surrealist. They met in in the 30s. I'm not so sure about the
timeline,
when they
yeah
if they met in New York before or if they met when. I think in 30
the movie seven. The movie says they met in Mexico, but the movie takes lots of liberties with facts.
In 38, I think around 38, he came to Mexico with his maybe wife. I don't know. I'm not sure. Some woman.
Well,
and
sorry if I interrupt you, but I think it was before the Second World War. I think it was 36 or something. It was shortly before the Second World War, before it broke out.
Okay, but that's not possible. It it has to be. Well, let's have a look. I have a biography. Yeah, it's 1938.
38, okay.
Jacqueline and André Breton.
That was very shortly, very short before the Second World War.
And then she has, in 38, she has this New Yorker, at the Julian Levy Gallery in New York, she has her first showing.
Mm-hmm.
First
exhibition.
Solo exhibition, and then in 39 she goes to Paris, and Trotsky comes to, just to clean that up.
Yeah,
Trotsky comes to in January 1937. Trotsky and his wife come to Mexico and live in the Blue House in Culiacán with her parents, with the father. The mother's already dead. So that's more or less the timeline, because, and that's important because she gifts Trotsky a self-portrait, and Breton sees this self-portrait of Frida at Trotsky's wall.
Oh, okay.
And he writes something about her and her relation to surrealism. So he celebrates her as a surrealist painter, and he writes an article about her, or an essay that becomes, I think, the foreword of the gallery showing in 38. And what he says is, about this painting he sees, "We are privileged to be present, as in the most glorious days of German romanticism, at the entry of a young woman endowed with all the gifts." And now you wonder what all the gifts are, and you probably think of, yeah, what a great paintress she is. But I'm coming back to the to Breton. "With all the gifts of seduction, one accustomed to the society of men of genius." Well, when I read that, I had basically to barf, because this is really, it's so incredible, you know? It's so incredible. He says, well, she's this great artist of seduction. So, and he ends this thing, it comes even better. He says that she's like Mexico in itself, and he has this Eurocentric view of Mexico. So like the European immigrants, and there were a lot to Mexico to that time. So it was like an immigration hot melting pot, more or less. So his view on Mexico was basically that of, oh, you have this indigenous culture, which is kind of interesting, and all the colors and that, and it's so emotional and expresses itself so purely. It has this relation to surrealism, because, but maybe it can't do it with the brain, more or less. That's my interpretation of
this,
that
kind,
and
of
it's
exoticism.
Yes, it's exoticism. So it has this kind of racist note to it too. And then he combines the two of them. So he says, "While I was in Mexico, I felt bound to say that I could think of no art more perfectly situated in time and space than hers." So hers is the perfect Mexican art. "I would like to add now that there is no art more exclusively feminine, in the sense that, in order to be as seductive as possible, it is only too willing to play alternately at being absolutely pure and absolutely pernicious. The art of Frida Kahlo is a ribbon around a bomb." Well, I love the last sentence, but, you know, everything which is said before, also that she is not shy of showing the strange ecstasies of puberty, well, basically female sexuality and giving birth and nakedness and blood and all that things, for him is like, well, in some colder climates, you wouldn't show that, but you would say that's private, which is kind of, well, I can't even... it's like, you know, it's racist. It's also
chauvinistic.
It's chauvinistic, and it's also saying, okay, the art of the woman is seduction and nothing more.
Yeah.
And that's completely something that Hayden Herrera, not only when she talks about the self-portrait of Frida that she gave to Trotsky, that she completely took over, but that shows in the whole biography of her that it's always about her in relation to men and her trying to seduce someone.
Hmm.
So her whole, the way she presented herself is always about influencing, manipulating men. And that's something like a trope of when you go to cinema and also have a look on Stardom, you see that all the narratives of women that are there, and also in the 30s and 40s, like in film noir or whatever, you have the trope of the femme fatale, or the woman that tries to become independent. She struggles for independence, and for that she needs men, and she manipulates them through her seduction. And at the end, she gets destroyed. She has to be punished for her immoral ways of trying to be independent. And that's basically the main narrative of Hayden Herrera's biography of Frida Kahlo.
Which is, I remember that you, in your talk, you presented an excerpt of her letters, where she expressed her views of André Breton and what Paris was looking like. I didn't know if we can't cite it directly because we only have the German versions.
Yeah,
but maybe you can summarize, because it's absolutely brilliant what Frida Kahlo herself thought of André Breton and Paris and the French.
Well, so in 1939, she comes to Paris expecting... So Breton invited her to Paris, saying he's going to organize an exhibition there for her because Paris will love her and she has to come and blah, blah, blah. So in 1939, she's freshly divorced from Diego Rivera. So she has no more money support, financial support, because she refuses to take money from him anymore. So she's it's important for her to sell pictures, which went very well in New York, and now she hopes in Paris this will also become a success. She comes to Paris. The first thing that happens is she learns that all her paintings that she sent are still at the customs, because Breton has no money and he didn't give a shit about her coming, more or less, because he didn't went to the customs to get her paintings out of there. So nothing is organized. There's no gallery. No one knows that she's there. And the first thing is she has to go to the hospital because she became really sick. She became a bacterial infection. And the doctors tell her that probably she ate something that wasn't properly washed, like salad, for example. So that happened to her in Paris in 1939. I went to Mexico last year. And this is something, talking about kind of racism and stereotypes, you know, that is something that people tell you now the other way around. So don't eat fruit that gets washed, that's not properly washed, blah, 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 blah. And this is that was the first thing for me that I found really funny, you know. And she digresses then that it's so dirty and the Europeans are such slobs, and also like the Civil War raged already for some years, and she's accusing the Europeans or the people living in Paris to not caring about what happens there and really treating immigrants,
refugees,
2018, 2017, refugees like shit, and not taking a care, and also not taking care of the democracies, and making a play for Mussolini and Hitler. So she, it shows that she has a very political consciousness, that she's very clever, that she's seeing a lot of things. And now we come to the really funny part about Breton, besides from, you know, being dirty and lazy and everything. The only one who helps her, so she basically says that they are all a-holes. That's really, that's in there. that he's a little shit. That's also in there. And the only guy who's great is Marcel Duchamp. who is the one who helps her get the pictures from the customs and also organizes a gallery showing for her then. And the gallery then, when they see the pictures, she also sent photos, which no one saw. So they didn't see the photographies. And when they see the photographies of the pictures, they are like, oh, that's much too shocking. We can only show two. So it's like, what the fuck is going on here? So she basically hates it. She hates Breton. She thinks he's the dumbest person ever. She hates the intellectuals of Paris who only sit in cafes and talk about intellectual bullshit and don't do anything. And the next morning they have nothing to eat because they don't work. And she writes that to several friends and is like, you know, you don't do that. You always work. You are a communist, but you work. And that's the most important thing. And I work as well. I'm always working. And for her, it's a complete different... She can't understand what's going on with this crazy people, and she's more than happy to finally come back to Mexico. But apart from that whole Breton thing, which is really funny when you heard what Breton thinks of her and what she thinks of him, is that the exhibition in Paris was really successful. The Louvre bought a painting. It was the first one by a Latin American artist they bought. And also the other artists like Picasso and Kandinsky and I don't know who else congratulated her. So that was really great. But when she came back to Mexico, she basically found out that some of the other paintings that she sold were bought by Diego through someone else, so that the money she was living off was from Diego, so she wasn't as independent as she thought, and which was a really hard blow for her. And so this also for me is something which makes it really difficult to, you know, the more I read about her and from her in the letters and the diary, is like, well, yeah, you can totally read this whole Diego love story as the most important thing like in her life. But there's so much more, and that's also so important.
Yeah.
And it's like, because there you have a letter where she's like, Diego, you are my life, the love of my life, and I know you can't be faithful, but, well, I'm not faithful either, more or less. And so they kind of made that deal. But when he asked her to marry him again, she says yes. And yeah, so that's...
I think it's really interesting what you said, that basically Hayden Herrera reproduced André Breton's perspective on her rather than her perspective, which probably was available to her. I mean, I can't imagine that Hayden Herrera did not read Frida Kahlo's letters, right? I
mean, she did. She also quotes them. She had access to basically everything when she wrote this... so she quotes some of the letters, and she also quotes like letters she wrote to doctors, but she chooses differently. So I think one thing which really angered me a lot is that you have in her letters, you learn that she... So the other thing that Hayden Herrera makes out to be the big tragedy of her whole life is that she couldn't have children with Diego. And there are some quotes that suggest that. So like immediately after she loses a child, I mean, who wouldn't be sad about that? Sorry. But there are letters before, when she's in Detroit. She writes to her doctor, Leo Ilerser, and wants his feedback what the doctor said. So she thinks that she can't have children and that she should abort because of her stability and everything. And she thinks that would be the clever thing to do. Because the doctor in Detroit says, no, you can keep it. You should keep it, more or less. And then the next letter to the doctor that is quoted in this book I have is like, you know what, thanks for your letter and thanks for encouraging me. to have the child. Nevertheless, I lost it.
Yes.
And what Hayden Herrera then writes in her biography is like, it's more or less her fault because she tried to have that baby against all common sense. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, it's a complete different thing from what the doctors told her.
Yes.
And what she wanted to do. Yeah. She wanted to abort the baby. So it's like, okay, what has she read what I haven't read? Or was that just the more fitting interpretation in this picture of this kind of sick woman, kind of emotional woman, and who desperately tried to have a baby? Because that's what women do, you know,
yeah.
Become mothers.
It's a little bit odd now that you're talking about it so passionately. I remember, I have to admit that I have never read the book. There's a book written in the late 1990s, I think. If I remember it correctly, it's simply called Backlash, which is a book about the Reagan era in the US,
mm-hmm.
so mostly the uh-huh. 1980s,
yeah.
Trying to undo basically the progress of feminists
yes.
from the 60s and 70s. And the more you talk about it, the more I think, yet that sounds like a book which was written in this kind of period of
so
backlash.
Yeah.
Once again, I can't say that much because I only heard about the book, but it might be interesting to, you know, analyze Hayden Herrera's book as a piece of its own time. And it's still fascinating that in a certain way it created this icon of Frida Kahlo. Nonetheless, maybe it's not really the real Frida we get there, but still, I mean, Frida Kahlo now is something of a feminist icon. Certainly, she's also her icon for style and fashion, and for also for in a certain way for queer communities, because she was definitely bisexual.
Yep.
At least that you would what's what you would call her today, which is interesting in itself.
Well, I think, I mean, you already talked about her being very unconventional for the
yeah.
time too, and she also gender dressed, which was kind of cross-dressed, which was kind of a fashion thing in that
yeah.
time.
The 1920s were a very
yes.
Experimental, to put it that way.
Yes. So she also cross-dressed in the 1920s already.
Mm.
And I think what she became really famous for, and that's like an iconic sign of her, which is, I think, unparalleled, is her eyebrows.
Yeah.
Which totally defeat female beauty standards.
Yes.
Because her eyebrows, if you haven't seen those, I mean, just Google it. You'll find iconic images of those. They are basically one big black eyebrow, more or less. Well, that's if you look at her self-portraits, and her self-portraits are like the biggest part of her work.
Yeah.
Show them like that. But if you see pictures of her, like photographies, you see it's not so strong. So it's not really one eyebrow. She totally exaggerated that in her paintings by herself. Also, like, she had a bit of like a female mustache
mm-hmm.
thing. I mean, she was like half European, half Indio descent. So she's very dark complexion, kind
mm-hmm.
of. So, and you see dark hair more on the skin. So there was like a shadow there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the pictures, there are pictures of her where the like portraits she did. It's totally exaggerated also, this mustache thing. So, and she portrayed herself also in a in a male dress, like with short hair
mm-hmm.
and everything. So she played with, I think basically in nearly every picture you have not only the female side but also male side that she's showing. And I think this is really very interesting, and that's also part of the iconic character nowadays.
Yeah. Before we started recording the podcast, we talked about an article in The Guardian, because in London, if you are in London right now, you should go and see an exhibition in the Victoria and Albert Museum, which has a huge exhibition about Frida Kahlo, especially her private belongings and stuff like that. And in the Guardian, there was an article about Frida Kahlo as a fashion icon, basically. And it's very interesting to consider Frida Kahlo in today's terms as somebody who has pioneer of what you today would call body positivity, right? I mean, somebody that you know you are good looking as you are, not as the something that society wants you to be, and you are interesting and beautiful, and that's, you know, you don't have to adhere to the beauty standards of whatever person around you. You can be something else entirely, and that's very interesting because it's an idea that we are now, that we have more respect for now than back in the day. But back in the day, it still created this kind of unique look because Frida Kahlo is possibly someone that you would recognize by the way she looked in almost every kind of circumstance, right? Mm-hmm. She's possibly one of the few persons. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Marilyn Monroe would be a similar icon. But in the case of Marilyn Monroe, this was not entirely her doing. We know that the directors Marilyn Monroe worked with had a huge influence on her looks. But in the case of Frida Kahlo, it was entirely her own, interpretation of what she wanted to present to the world, which brings me to a little bit to the next point that we have here on our notes, which is this kind of self-staging thing that she is somebody who was very conscious about what she looked like and her image.
So basically what you're going to see in the Victoria and Albert Museum are all of her dresses that normally you can only see if you go to the Blue House in Koyakan, where her exhibition is. And the dresses are part of her, not only the reason why she became a fashion icon, but also of her becoming an icon in itself. So what she became famous for is, for one, having flowers in her hair, which was always, or most of the time, in some kind of
wreath.
Yes, thank you. The eyebrows and some kind of jewelry.
Yeah.
And then dresses that have a folkloristic Mexican heritage or appearance, because she made them up herself. So it's not like she's following strictly one Mexican style or tradition.
Sorry.
She totally mixes them and creates her own style. Which and quotes also things or periods. I think that's
which is interesting because today, if you show somebody a picture of Frida Kahlo, they would say, "Okay, that's just Mexican," or authentic in a certain way. But if you look at that in modern qualities, it's more of like a remix of Mexican styles and traditions than something authentic. But I mean, it's very interesting because we are talking about the Frida Kahlo through the time, basically. And we now have at least three different images that we have talked about. We have Frida Kahlo self-staging herself, the kind of pictures that she presented to the world in the form of her self-portraits. We have Hayden Herrera's books, which came 30 years after her death. And then 20 years later, we had the movie, right? And they are all different interpretations of the same person, which we can't really, you know, we have her letters and the letters of her friends and documents of photographs, but we don't have, I don't think there's a movie or film that she ever was caught on film or something. Probably not, because...
Yeah, I mean, there were other movies and documentaries about her life and everything.
Yeah, but that's true. She also
showed a lot of photos.
Lots of photos, yes. I mean, she was living among artists who, of course, photographed her a lot. But possibly the latest interpretation of her personality or her person came in the movie, Pixar movie Coco, where yep. she has a short appearance. At least that's what we found out. We neither of us has seen the movie. It would have been interesting in the context of this
But
talk.
We're going to
watch it and then we'll report back. But I don't know. You had, when we talked about before we started recording the podcast, you talked about the kind of problem that Hayden Herrera's works has, and the kind of, despite its influence, that the problem was that she is conflating the self portraits
yes.
With the artist's life.
Yeah.
And it's also something that the movie actually does very Absolutely. Strongly, because yeah. actually some of the most interesting, I think, features of the movie are that there's a kind of blending of the pictures, the paintings of Frida Kahlo and the staging of the movie itself. But you had very strong feelings about this kind of presentation and the conflation of the pictures and the paintings.
I mean,
from
a visual perspective. So talking about the movie now, from a visual perspective, and also from kind of an interpretation of her as a surrealist painter, that makes totally sense to blend that into each other. But really, the problem here is that her life story is so dramatic and so overshadowing everything, that if you say that her paintings are only reflecting her life and you take that one on one, you will completely lose her more or less as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You don't take the works for themselves, because the woman and her life become so much more important.
Yes.
And I mean, maybe it is like that. I'm not an art historian, but what I can say is that I think she was really the first female artist who portrayed herself so excessively that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
So, and who became famous for that too. And I think that for itself is like tremendous. And mm-hmm. that gets totally lost in this, oh, see the pain here, the corset she has to wear. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, dear Frida, a pity, and everything. You know, mm-hmm. It's not stepping back and looking at the picture like, okay, this is a really interesting picture, cleverly done, da 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 da. And also, it doesn't take into account that she's presenting a mask
mm.
on all of her self-portraits.
You mentioned a book by Goffman, I think,
yeah,
The Presentation of Self.
He's a sociologist and quite famous. So my background is in theater, so I had to read him, because what he wrote is, what's the English title again?
The Presentation of Self?
In Everyday Life.
In Everyday
so,
Life.
So he's taking the metaphor of theater. So, you know, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. Everyone knows that, Shakespeare, hello. And he takes that more or less and explains the roles every one of us plays in life. So in every interaction with someone, you play a role. And that's basically the idea. And you can analyze it like that, your behavior with a theater point of view, which is super interesting. And if you look at what she's doing, this self-staging thing, she wears costumes more or less.
Mm.
In her self-portraits, she chooses which symbols she puts on there, which kind of, like, there's one self-portrait in a Tijuana dress
mm-hmm.
where she's quoting explicitly one time and one period in Mexican culture that is very, it's a matriarchal
society,
thank
yeah.
you. So that, I think, has to be taken into account, that self-portraits are not, you have to interpret them, and not only based on the life of the person, but also with a political, historical, societal perspective.
Mm.
So take, for example, the self-portrait she gave to Leon Trotsky,
mm.
who was like the famous communist with an international Bolsheviki following. And she gives him a picture which is not in her characteristic, folkloristic Mexican style, which is like the dress of the people. No, she's dressed completely bourgeois, and she says, she hands it to him on the date on it is the 7th November of 1937, which is like the 20th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. So that's not his birthday. It's not something personal. It's really, it's an historic date with a meaning. And she has even like a theater
curtains
on the picture. And you can interpret that like Breton, who has this, oh, the stage for the mind of the artist opens here. Or you can say, well, it's a stage that happens here because all the bourgeois are following you, Trotsky, the communist. And it's not like, it's not the people. So you can read that as criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't come up with that, by the way. I read another book by an art historian. It's called Devouring Frida, The Art History and Popular Celebrity of Frida Kahlo. Her name is Margaret A. Lindauer, and that's like a feminist interpretation of Frida Kahlo and also the interpretations of Frida Kahlo. I can only recommend it. It's super interesting.
We had a little bit of a discussion earlier because I thought you actually, you know, Frida Kahlo is bearing part of her soul, I said, when in her paintings, but you corrected me in a certain way because you're much deeper in this kind of you know much more about her than I do, and I think the interesting parallel is because there are not so many art painters who have had so many self-portraits as the subject of their paintings. And the one I had to think of was Francis Bacon, who is known for these kind of deformed faces, these formed portraits, and very often self-portraits of himself and showing himself in agony, basically. It's very interesting in that to see the parallels between the two, because the paintings of Bacon are not really surrealist. They still have this kind of, it's more expressionist in a certain way.
Yeah.
And he also had a very troubled life, to put it that way, because he was homosexual in time in the UK when homosexuality was still, illegal but I think it's very interesting to see how Frida is what you said, also hiding behind a mask in a certain way. He also said that this kind of storytelling, this is some kind of storytelling, right? That she is putting forward a certain picture of herself. And you made this kind of comparison to the book by Goffman, Storytelling Animal.
That's Gottschall.
Gottschall, sorry. Yeah, I'm mixing up the two writers here. Gottschall, The Storytelling Animal. Maybe you can explain a little bit more what you meant with that.
To boil it down to one sentence is what he says is that people are born storytellers. So everything we do, we can't not do it as story because our brain is wired that way. And that's his reason to come up with the title that humans are storytelling animals. So we learn through story, we live through story, and we also, we form our lives in stories because what we share with each other is storytelling. So our whole interaction is based on stories. The way we learn, our brains are based on stories, and that's also why we crave stories. And that's combined with this, we all play theater, so we are staging something, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious. That together, I think, also leads here to there are more possibilities to and more or different versions on how you can read a life. It really depends on who tells the story about someone.
Yeah, which is interesting because we all have this kind of story in the pictures, paintings of Frida Kahlo, which she has left for us to puzzle over in a certain way, because she, of course, she was a visual artist and wasn't somebody who has, like us, who's writing it down, basically, and she's left that to other people to do. And well, sometimes she ends up with something like Hayden Herrera's biography, which is, well, maybe not entirely off the point, but, you know, something else entirely than what the historical person might have been, actually.
Yeah, well, or she's only showing a part of it. I think it's her, because she's so strong opinioned on this whole mother complex, wife complex, seductress thing, that it feels like it can be only one part of the whole story. And that's for every biopic or every biography, it might be the case. I don't know, because I think as the one writing it down, you can't keep yourself out completely.
Of course. This is the interesting question to return to, because that's something that we basically, this big theme of our today's episode of our podcast, how can you actually do a biopic or a biography of someone, because it's always a big challenge, because of course people are very complex. No biography can ever aggregate everything a human life was made of, because it's just too much material after all, and the complexities of personalities who might have been which might have been positive in one situation and might be seen negatively in another situation, is something that almost every kind of biopic struggles with. I mean we have had lots of successful biopics in the last few years. It's basically a little, a genre of its own, with stuff like Walk the Line, for example, which was the Johnny Cash biopic, or he had the life of Ray Charles in a biopic. You had there's so many. You now have the Queen, which is on Netflix.
The Crown,
which is on Netflix, I think.
Yeah.
And which is an entire series of made out of the life of one person. You have had stuff like the Harvey Weinstein movie, The King's Speech, which was about another king of Britain, and things like that, where they try to make the King's Speech is interesting in that regard, that it takes a particularly episode of life in order to tell that to the public, instead of trying to recreate the entire life.
I think that's the problem I have with Frida, to come back to that, is it presents the whole life and it's told through the lens of Frida being part of that marriage.
Yeah.
So, in my view, it should be Frida and Diego, the name of the movie, because that's really what it is about. The relationship those two people had with each other. And still, it's told from a very male-centered perspective.
Yes.
But we talked about that already.
Yes.
So, I think, I don't know, I mean, Shakespeare in Love, for example...
Which was entirely fictional, because we don't know absolutely nothing about Shakespeare's life, at least not nothing with certainty.
But still, you had this figure, this historic figure, Shakespeare, the writer, and with all these theater plays, and we don't even know if he wrote them all. anyhow, but you know something about this person, and then you make a story out of it, but it's clearly fictional. Yes. And still, it has some kind of... You know, the Globe Theater and blah, 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 and blah, 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 and women weren't allowed on stage and all that. So you have some kind of historic background and build a fictional story
on top of that. Yeah.
And then you have the other movie we saw on the Story Drive, you know, Shakespeare by Emmerich.
Oh, yeah. Anonymous was that.
Yes, okay.
Anonymous. Which was, for those who haven't seen it, was a movie by Roland Emmerich, who's basically best known for his disaster movies, like, Independence Day. And stuff like that. And he made a movie about Shakespeare, where basically Shakespeare is a fraud, and the actual plays were written by, I don't remember who, some noble, count, duke, something, lord of blah, blah, blah. Which, of course, is also entirely fictional because there's nothing to prove the authorship of that person being Shakespeare either. And he basically made it into a little bit of a, well, Game of Thrones thing in a certain way. I mean, it definitely had a feeling of that because it was, you know,
entertainment.
Yes, court intrigue and stuff like that. Yeah, I think that approach, especially if you have a person, if you have a historical person where you have huge blanks in the life of them, is perfectly valid to do that because it's still. I think everybody who has lived before the times of before the 19th century, when you didn't have the kind of faithful reproductions of in the form of photographs or something, where you don't really know all that much about, is perfectly fair to do that. I think becomes a little bit more of a problem when you enter the 20th century, when you have so much material about the lives of people, and suddenly you can take their letters and their photographs and compare them to a movie or a book.
And then you suddenly realize, if you read through all the letters of one person, how boring a life also can be.
True.
And then you get into conflict with storytelling because, I mean, just imagine sitting in the cinema having to watch over and over again how someone does his or her shopping or whatever without conflict, without interaction with other interesting people. So probably that's always the problem you're faced if you do a biopic about someone.
That's probably why there is no real biopic about Franz Kafka. He is perhaps one of the most interesting and well-known writers of the 20th century, but he had an extremely boring life. There is a movie, I know.
Soderbergh movie.
Yes, there is.
That's very arty.
Yes, and very surreal. Yeah. But I mean, this is exactly the point. He basically goes, he doesn't say, you know, it's not a real biopic.
Yeah,
it's just
true.
Something that uses his work to create an entirely fictional story about, but that, which is interesting. I mean, I have to say that one of the perhaps most interesting biopics that I've seen in my life was Mishima by Paul Schrader, which is about the Japanese writer Yukio Mishima, who was an extremely controversial and contradictory person. And the movie actually doesn't try, it's very arty, it's extremely arty, and doesn't really try to retell the story of Mishima in any coherent way. It's just parts of his work juxtaposed with parts of his biography and parts of the last day in his life. It has these three levels, basically, which are constantly intercut. And it's very interesting as a movie, but of course it's something that is so arty that nobody really has seen that movie, I think.
Well, actually, I haven't seen it, I have to confess.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you for it because it's really obscure.
And at the moment, I can't think of another biopic I've seen. Well, I've seen Walk the Line, sure, and I've seen a Francis Bacon movie about his life.
Yes.
I can't remember the name.
We probably have seen more than we can remember because lots of them are a little bit irrelevant, I would say, sometimes.
Something I wanted to bring into the discussion earlier was when you talked about Francis Bacon.
Yes.
So like other artists.
Yes.
What I think is very interesting, or what I also read online in one of the Guardian articles, is would Frida Kahlo be on Instagram today? I think probably not. The writer was from a different was of a different opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that when we think about other female artists and the kind of like self-staging, Cindy Sherman comes to mind.
Tracy Emin,
and also kind of Sophie Kaye.
Niki de Saint Phalle, maybe too. Well, not so much.
Yeah, I don't know.
Her early work is probably when she was when she had developed the Nanas.
Yeah.
She her work became much more abstract than it was in her early stages. But I don't know. Yeah.
I only know the Nanas.
Well, that's what she's best known for. But yeah. Never mind.
And the Tarot Garden in Tuscany.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. Let me think. Which artists, other famous female artists, are known for? I mean, we have definitely mentioned some of the most contemporary, most important ones.
And then the other thing is, what I also read, that in the list of the 100 artists who make most money, I think you have only 5 women.
Which I think is very typical for the
art business. So, yeah. Is still a very male-focused one. And I think it's quite typical that she has... that Frida Kahlo now has more or less a fashion show. And yes. That people that are quoted about her influence are... on her influence are pop stars like Madonna.
Which is an interesting side story, that the prices for Frida Kahlo's work went up because Madonna started to collect her works. So
then you have fashion designers and graphic designers that are influenced by her style.
Yes. Well, at least you can say she had an impact on the pop culture, on today's pop culture. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes you have these kind of completely obscure artists, which are, you know, where the experts are freaking out about, but aren't really well known for the mainstream, in the mainstream. So I don't know, in a certain way, maybe it's not so bad for Frida Kahlo. It's would be interesting to know what she would have thought about that. I have to, another artist which comes to mind, which has, I just think about Louise Bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
He has, of course, her work is extremely abstract, but is also this kind of, definitely there is a reflection of her own life in her works, which is very eerie in a certain way. Very interesting artist. She's probably also very expensive now that she has died, I think something like 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which brings us to our last point today. Recommendations for maybe something to go on and learn something about. I think you have something to learn something about Frida Kahlo, right?
Yes. So for me, the coolest thing I read in my research about her, well, the Margaret A. Lindauer book, if you are into art history, is super interesting, Devouring Frida, because it's like trying to pick up on all the narratives that surround Frida Kahlo and bring them in a perspective. So it's like a feminist analysis of the analysis of Frida Kahlo and of Frida Kahlo's work. So this is super cool. And the other I can totally recommend is to read letters by Frida Kahlo, especially starting in the 30s. She's super funny, she's super honest, and she has really a lot to tell. So there's one book in English, Frida by Frida, and the contributor is Raquel Tibol. I'm not so sure how to pronounce that. And maybe one last thing from Frida is, already in 1925, she has a fight with her then boyfriend and about a girl, and the girl feels offended that he says, "You are like Frida Kahlo." And so she hears that, Frida hears that, and her reaction is, "Well, you know what? I think she can be offended because I am like I am, and I really like myself like I am." So that's like 100 years before the, more or less 100 years before the Dove thing, Love Yourself campaign, the whole thing, you know, is like Frida already had that in 1925. And I think that's also the reason why I picked her, because I think she's really just cool.
Yes, it's very cool. My recommendation is a little not so well-known movie, which is called, it's a French movie by the name of Séraphine. By the director is Martin Provost, and the lead actress is Yolande Moreau, she is absolutely fantastic in that movie. It has to be said that this movie really lives from her performance. No, throwing no shade on Salma Hayek's work in Frida. She was probably one of the best parts of that movie, and at least in my view. But Yolande Moreau's performance is really on an entirely different planet, to say it that way. It's about a little-known French artist called Zéraphine de Senlis, who was one of the what you called amateur art movement, and she was a very important representative of that, because she had never had a formal education, and she never had really a big exhibition during her lifetime. And this kind of it's a biopic, and it's I think one of the best biopics that I've seen in that regard about a painter and a female painter at that. And I can only recommend it, because it might be hard to get, because it's I think there is definitely a DVD out there, but I don't know if there's even a Blu-ray. And well, if you are making a trip to France, maybe check out the small town of Senlis, where there is a small museum with her works. It's very, very fascinating and highly recommended by me. So, this is probably the end of our episode.
Yeah, that's a wrap. Ha ha.
Please like, comment, and subscribe. No, you don't have to do that. We're just fine if you just listen to us. And
but you can totally do that.
We can totally do that. And give us 5 stars on whatever platform you can find, because that's very important to be discovered, because there's so much stuff out there. No. After all, we're just doing this for ourselves, after all. Maybe not entirely, but we are perfectly fine with just talking to each other forever.
Okay, <finish. laughs>
See you next time.
See you next time.